I'm someone who certainly was not a natural writer, and it was very much at the beginning a struggle for me. Some people might say that's because on the one hand I come from New Zealand and on the other I trained in general surgery, and so for both of those reasons, the English will appreciate this, I have difficulty using words of more than one or two syllables at a time. But the whole thing about writing is that it's a lifelong process of self-improvement and getting better. But if we've got a message to put across, then that's crucially important. So, first of all, but just so you know where I'm coming from, I come from New Zealand. I trained as a general surgeon. I was called out of clinical medicine in the early 90s, and then I went into full-time student ministry with a Christian Medical Fellowship, which I did for 9 years, and then I became the CEO of that organization for another 18 years, and CMF is a fellowship of about 5,000 doctors and medical students throughout the UK and Ireland. And then just and then during that time, I got very much involved in public policy issues, particularly life issues at the beginning and end of life. So a lot of what I've written on in the past is in that area. And for 12 years, I was the director of a group called Care Not Killing, which lobbies against the legalization of euthanasia. We set it up in 2006. And then 3 years ago, I left Christian Medical Fellowship and Care Not Killing, and I joined or became the CEO of another organization called ICMDA, the International Christian Medical and Dental Association, which brings together national associations of Christian doctors and dentists in about 80 countries worldwide. So if you're familiar with the IFES, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, we're like the IFES for Christian medical groups around the world. So just so you know, that's my background. So we've got five modules to get through as we go, and we're going to stop as we go along for discussion, for Q&A, and particularly for exercises that you'll do in groups. And I hope that much of what you take away from this will be things that you're doing yourselves in the exercises. Wonderful quote, "The pen is mightier than the sword." It was a guy called Edward Bulwer Lytton who wrote this in a play called Cardinal Richelieu back in 1839. And by 1840, Cardinal Richelieu speaks these words in the play. And he's working, he's a chief minister for Louis XIII, and there's a plot to kill him. And he says, well, the pen is mightier than the sword. There are other weapons other than violence, you see, to influence. And so this word was in common currency. By 1840, everyone was using it. And everyone, of course, has forgotten its origin. But there have been writers that have shaped cultures and shaped the course of history. Just some of the examples of writing that has had a phenomenal effect in world history. So Confucius, of course, and his influences in East Asia, Euclid's Elements. I know we've got at least one mathematician here with us. Plato's Republic, of course, which provided a lot of the framework for Greek philosophy. And we know about Socrates, of course, from the writings of Plato. And then, of course, think of the Quran, which supposedly came down through an angel in 630 AD, to the Prophet Muhammad, and of course is a phenomenal shaper of opinion and worldview and politics and history all over the world. Adolf Hitler didn't write much, but his ideas had their effects, didn't they? And then these two intellectuals, Engels and Marx, who back in the middle of the 19th century produced a book, The Communist Manifesto, which provided the intellectual framework and presuppositions for what followed in the communist world and shaped phenomenally 70 years of history from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution until the late 80s, and is still shaping. And as we speak here, we see its effects happening just further east in Ukraine. And then Mao Zedong's Little Red Book. These two books, respectively, the Communist Manifesto and the Little Red Book of Mao Zedong, were probably responsible for at least 80 million deaths when people took their ideas and acted them out. And then there's the American Constitution, so we could go on, but you know, you get the point. Writing changes the world. And then there's also writing that shapes cultures as well. Shakespeare's already been mentioned. And Shakespeare, of course, brought a Christian and a biblical worldview very much into British culture and is still quoted very much today. The Origin of the Species, 1859, completely shaped the course of modern Europe. And along with the Enlightenment and the liberal theologians of the early 19th century, plus Charles Darwin, those three influences were the main influences in shaping the continent in which we live now. Simone Beauvoir, The Second Sex, Radical Feminism, the idea in her quote that she became a woman, and all the philosophical and presuppositions behind that statement are really what's paved the way for what we're living through now. Judith Butler, most people never heard of Judith Butler, an American academic, but she really laid the intellectual framework for the whole transgender movement, which is here now. So the point is that what gets whispered in the ivory towers of universities and written in documents and circulated in books has a profound effect in shaping cultures and will eventually be shouted in the streets by and believed by everyone and lived out. Richard Dawkins, of course, one of what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse, with Dawkins and three major colleagues who had an incredible influence in shaping the kind of post-Christian environment which is hostile to Christian faith and values that we live in today. But then, of course, the most influential book in the whole world is none of these but the Bible, which has been translated into many more, read by more, and so on. And of course, it's the translations that have made it accessible. Not many people spoke Hebrew or ancient Greek, but it was translating the Bible into Latin, first of all, through the Vulgate, 4th century. And then, of course, the big contribution of the Reformation was to make the Bible available in the vernacular. So Erasmus's Greek New Testament, even though he was not a Puritan or evangelical, but his Greek New Testament paved the way for the Reformation because it's what people like Tyndale and Luther used to make the Bible accessible. And there was a debate recently about who the most influential British person ever was. Some people said Churchill, some people said Shakespeare. Others pointed to members of the royalty and so on. But I think actually the most influential British person that there's ever been is William Tyndale. And if you go down to the River Thames today, just near Parliament, there's a statue of Tyndale on the waterfront there. But it was Tyndale translating the Bible into English that profoundly shaped British culture. There would never have been a Churchill or a Shakespeare without Tyndale, first of all. So this is the book that made your world and the worlds of Vishal Mangalwadi. If you've not read Mangalwadi's book, then I'd encourage you to. I think it's a wonderful explanation of how the Bible shaped every single aspect of European culture. And if you want to understand Europe, you really need it'll certainly help you to read the writings of this Indian evangelical academic, who, because he lived outside Europe, is able to look at Europe objectively and see the things that we can't see. When I'd been told by three separate Christian leaders on three separate occasions that I had to read this book, I finally went and bought a copy, and it sat on my bedside table for about 6 months before I opened it, but then I couldn't get past it. Really, really very helpful. And of course, we know that God's word has incredible power. That's how God exerts his power, his creative power to make the universe, his sustaining power, which upholds it, upholding the universe by his word of power. We're told in Hebrews 1:3 of Christ that his word is a two-edged sword which cuts to the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and discerns the thoughts and intentions of the heart. That word became flesh, that it brings new life, and that, of course, it has all these effects in growing us. So, words. This beautiful quote from Isaiah: as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. And Paul, of course, talks about the power of the words that he spoke as an apostle to correct error, to tear down strongholds, and to persuade others. And he talked about spiritual warfare being the use of words of truth spoken in the public square, which changed the hearts and minds of people and led to their conversion. And he talks about taking thoughts captive. And I think that's a great theme to think about when we're wanting to think of our role as writers, that a lot of it is about capturing thoughts and taking them captive and refuting lies and misconceptions and delusions and deceptions in order to make a way for truth to be accepted and to bring about the change that it does. So just think too about influential Christian authors and the incredible debt that we owe to people like Jonathan Edwards or John Owen, who were probably the intellectual giants during that amazing time during the 18th century of the New England Revival in the US and the Evangelical Revival in the UK, which led on to the incredible missionary movement that we've seen throughout the 19th, going into the 20th century, and the global church as it is today. Or Augustine, who all the strands of Christianity look back to, his City of God, Martin Luther's 95 Theses, when he wrote those words and nailed them to the door at Wittenberg, they changed history. Calvin, who applied these beliefs politically, and so on. So, and then, you know, you've got your own favorite authors. These are some of mine. And when I was a teenager, my father tried in vain for many years to persuade me to read C.S. Lewis, and I never listened to him. And then, of course, I got to the age of 18, and I was at medical school in my fourth year, and I discovered C.S. Lewis, and I read 20 books by C.S. Lewis in 1 year, and it really changed the direction of my life. And I wondered why I hadn't listened to my father earlier than that. But, you know, these are Francis Schaeffer, John Stott, Packer, Carson, Piper, and so on. You know, but we owe a huge debt to people to whom God has given the gift of writing and communication that's helped to shape our lives. So why do people write? What's the motivation? And people have different motivations. Sometimes it's just sheer egoism. These are Orwell's four reasons of writing, Orwell, 1984. Of course, An Animal Farm, The Road to Wigan Pier, and so on. Great novelists. They say that the two greatest novels of the 20th century and the most influential were 1984 and Brave New World. But why did Orwell write? Well, he said other people, some write for egoism. They just want their name in lights. They want to be famous. They want to be known as an author and a writer. And some people write for aesthetic enthusiasm. I think this is a great thing, just because they just love writing and the creative juices flowing. Others, a historical impulse, a desire to record things so that they're there for the future, so that we understand the course of our world. But then the final purpose, he says, is a political purpose. And when he was asked why he wrote, he said it was for a political purpose. And he's using the word political here in the widest possible sense. So it was a desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society that they should strive after. And this is a quote here from Orwell. The Spanish War and other events in 1936-37 turned the scale, And thereafter, I knew where I stood. Every line of serious work that I have written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism. The Road to Wigan Pier, 1937. Of course, 1984 was written in 1948 because he switched the digits around. But this was his motivator throughout his whole life, that he saw the evil of totalitarianism and he wanted to attack it. And so his ambition was to persuade others to change their thinking and behavior. And whatever sort of writing you're in, and whatever you end up writing, whether it's books or articles or blogs or novels or whatever, wherever your personality and past and giftings may take you and may lead you to focus, then I think this ambition of Orwell should be even more an ambition for us as Christian believers, that we want to challenge wrong thinking and to replace it with truth, because a person's worldview will profoundly shape the things that they believe and teach and say and the way they act, and therefore will have a profound effect on the trajectory of a culture as well. And now we live in a Europe where the fundamental worldview, which has captured all of the corridors of power, all of the mountains of culture, if you like, and I mean everything from parliament to the media to the worlds of art and entertainment to the universities, all of these, to the worlds of business and so on, all of these things in the West now have been captured by an atheist worldview, a secular humanist worldview, increasingly a woke worldview, which is shaping the whole directory of the culture in which we live. And so our ambition should be to teach the truth, because, as Jesus said, the truth sets people free, and to counter wrong ideas or error, because lies enslave. I got into a huge amount of trouble once when I was working with CMF early on, because I wrote an article about Islam, and I wrote the words, "Islam is an enslaving deception." And there were some people within, not very politically correct, I recognize that, but I held on to my job robustly. But even people in our organization were upset by this. But actually, if you think about it, it's a deception, because it teaches untruths about the nature of reality, and particularly about the nature of Christ. And it's enslaving, because it draws people into living their lives in terms of their beliefs and behavior into something that is going to be of absolutely no benefit at all and will ultimately destroy them. So there are lots of enslaving deceptions in the world, and a part of our role as Christians is to counter those and to counter the behaviors that come in them. So if we live in a society where a wrong idea, a perverse ideology has captured the corridors of power, then if we want to change the trajectory of the society in which we live, then we have to be able to counter those deceptions and false ideas in the corridors of power so that we influence the trajectory of our society.